Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. We've had about a year of racially charged violence and a renewed reflection on race across the country. But in one corner of the United States, a church has decided to make a move in the direction of accountability and reconciliation on its own. The Rhode Island Episcopal Diocese is planning a center for reconciliation in acknowledgement of both the state and the diocese's long involvement with the transatlantic slave trade in the 17th and 18th centuries. Rhode Island merchants may have controlled as much as 90% of the American trade in African slaves in the years following the revolution, and the state was once called the Deep North for its heavy involvement. The Reconciliation Center is among the first of its kind in the U.S. Bishop Nicholas Knisley, who has led the Rhode Island Episcopal Diocese since 2012, says his hope for the center is to serve as a kind of historical experience with artifacts, exhibits, performances, to help the community better understand the role of the church in this tiny northern state that played an outsized role in America's dark past.
We have been talking about how to do reconciliation in America. How do we as American people become reconciled with our history? How do we as American people become reconciled to one another so that we can live together as one nation and not see the inequities and the economic disparities and the law enforcement differences that we're seeing in the country today?
And so your Reconciliation Center sounds like it's a first step for that.
It really is. It grew out of some grassroots conversation here in Rhode Island among people when we were confronted with the question of a cathedral that had had its services suspended. And I asked the people around the state to dream about what we might do with this building. What mission might we take on as people of faith? And the thing that came out was people being brave enough to confront Rhode Island's history and to confront our history as American people of a place that is marked by our involvement in the slave industry.
Now, let's talk about that history a little bit, because at very first glance, blushing glance, you say, well, Rhode Island is New England. This is not South Carolina. This is not Georgia. What slave history? What exactly are you talking about?
Well, it's been a surprise to me to find out, but as a person who was born in the North, as I have begun to listen to people who've talked about the history of Northern slave ownership, we've discovered that Rhode Island in particular as a state, but all really of the North, has been participating in the slave industry in the 18th and 19th century to a much greater degree than I think any of us knew or understood. In Rhode Island, we know that many of the ships that brought people from Africa to the slave plantations in the South and into slavery in the North were sailing under Rhode Island registration. And Rhode Island as an economy, all the people of Rhode Island in those days were participating in this industry in direct and indirect ways.
So that means that if the ships were being built in Rhode Island, were disembarking from Rhode Island, the captains made their homes in Rhode Island, and the financiers did their banking in Rhode Island, that the economy of Rhode Island was implicitly and intimately intertwined with the slave trade.
Well, and the barrel makers and the people who were weaving cloth, the people who were dealing with the cotton that was coming off the plantations, yeah. But that was true for the whole country. It just is a place here in Rhode Island where we've had some really heroic and brave ways of families and individuals looking at their own history and looking at their legacies.
You have also talked about the role of your own church and some of its prominent members in the slave trade, the direct role of the Episcopal Church going back into the 18th century. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, so it's a mixed bag, and I think that's what we want to talk about as people of faith. And we want to talk about the way people of faith participated and were enriched by the slave industry, and we want to talk about the way that people of faith over the years, not as many Episcopalians as I'd like to say, participated in the work of abolition of slavery in the United States. But as an institution, even after abolition, even after the Civil War, the church has still benefited from the implications of slave trade. Many of our institutions were able to amass wealth in that time, and we still have income from those wealth-bearing industries. Some of the buildings that we use were built with money that comes from that period. Some of the structures within the church that still show inequities come directly from that period as well and propagate into our own day.
There is a long-running debate, argument in this country, as you know, sometimes a hurtful and ugly one, about apologies, about responsibility for slavery, what it means to try to reconcile or even apologize for something that you weren't directly involved in, or even maybe your ancestors weren't involved in. Maybe your family came here in the 20s. Can you talk about a response to that, whether direct descendancy from the slave trade is necessary here to be part of what you're talking about?
So let me be personal here for a second and say that as my family has done investigation into its own history, we who thought of ourselves as being from Pennsylvania and from the South were surprised to find out that we have deep roots here in Rhode Island and ancestors buried in graveyards across the street from Episcopal churches. And that when we've looked at the census data from that time in our own families, we've discovered that we were slave owners in that day. I think people don't really recognize the interconnectedness and how deeply we all are related to this. Now, as to questions of people who've come here after the Civil War, who've come here recently, a lot of American society is built still on this kind of inequity. Look at the question of how we did redlining in the way we did real estate in the cities. Look at how the GI Bill was disproportionately given to one group of GIs and not to another group of GIs. People get a leg up, and they're not always aware of the leg up that they've been given simply because they are identified as white or not. And people are being held back because they're identified as not white, even though we're pretty sure that those are societal constructions and have very little to do with ethnic or genetic structures.
Bishop Nicholas Knisley, I'm hearing a lot of commonality in what you're talking about with a book I read recently for our book club here on The Takeaway, and it was Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. He is a journalist at The Atlantic and an author of that book. He says that white Americans or Americans who think of themselves as white can't begin to reconcile with their treatment of African Americans until they realize on a visceral, even a practical level, that their social position has been built on the shoulders, if not the necks, of other people. And I hear a lot of common themes in what you're saying.
I absolutely agree. By the way, my book club of clergy is reading this book in the next month. In a conversation I had with a leader in the Episcopal Church about this question, he, as an African-American leader, said to me that we really have to start as white people by knowing our own history. The black community knows our history. We've lived in denial of it. And that's kind of at the core of what the Center for Reconciliation is about. We can't be reconciled with one another until we are all telling the truth. And this is about white people telling our truth to ourselves, as much as it might be someday issuing a kind of apology, though I'm not sure what the apology would look like or who would accept it. I'm not sure who has standing for it. We're not there yet. First, we have to know what we did.
Bishop Nicholas Knisley is the Episcopal Bishop of Rhode Island since 2012. The Rhode Island Episcopal Diocese has founded the Center for Reconciliation, an exploration of Rhode Island's role in the slave trade and the role of its people as well. Bishop, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
Well, as Rhode Island deals with its past, here are some more of your hometown stories before we go today. A listener in Austin, Texas writes, "My hometown of Cleveland was once one of the wealthiest cities in the country. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, a particularly grand two-mile stretch of Euclid Avenue was known as Millionaire's Row. Most all of the mansions are gone now, but fortunately, the theaters remain as an anchor in downtown Cleveland's renaissance."
Hi, this is Perry from Tampa, Florida. And in addition to its own rich history of gangsters, from Charlie Wall to Sancho Traficante, Tampa was also a popular vacation stop for other more famous mobsters like Al Capone. Of course, Miami was the better-known vacation stop, but that's because people knew where it was.
We're getting lots of great stories from you. That's all for today, but you can listen back to anything you heard on the show at thetakeaway.org. You can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thank you so much for listening. As always, I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.